Good afternoon, everyone. I call the State and Local Government Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order on March 17th, 2023. We do have a quorum present. I would like to know that I'd like you to know that we have people moving back and forth between multiple committees today, but a quorum is present. Representative Hewitt, did you have a chance to review the March 16th minutes?
Madam Chair, I have, and so moved.
Thank you. Is there any discussion to the March 16th minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We are going to move a little bit out of order because our first two bill authors are not here. So we'll begin with you, Representative Newton. And if you will begin with House File 2161.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Fellow members.
And it is our intention to lay House File 2061 over for possible inclusion.
Okay.
The bill is before us.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was brought to me by County Commissioners of Hennepin, Anoka and Ramsey Counties. And I have commissioners from each of those counties here who would like to present the bill.
Great. Let's
start with Commissioner Metaxas-Castillo.
If you will please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And please make sure that you're speaking into the microphone so it can be picked up.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everyone, members of the committee. I'm Trista Matas-Castillo. I'm chair of the Ramsey County Board of Commissioners. I just first want to start with saying thank you for hearing our bill, and thank you for Representative Newton for carrying this bill, and Representative Herr, who has signed on as co-author as a Ramsey County legislator. We're seeking this change this year for a variety of reasons. It's a change to our current makeup of our library board. At Ramsey County, we've adopted a residents first model. We have been working to build out our county service centers to more efficiently and effectively serve our residents. And we want to integrate our library services more efficiently into the rest of the county's operations. And in order to do that, we need to adjust the library board from being a separate governing body to an advisory structure to incorporate into Ramsey County. Under the current statute, the library board's responsibilities include exclusive control of funding expenditures credited to the library and the grounds, rooms, and buildings provided for library purposes. Under this new governance structure, the county will have the authority to control library's budget, make policy more consistent with county operations, and hire staff. Finally, the advisory role we are seeking is consistent with the other resident boards and commissions that we currently have throughout Ramsey County, to include things like parks and recs, public health advisories, corrections, human services. And by clarifying the relationships across the library board, the county board, and the county manager, all parties will be more effective at working together and executing our residents first model through a lens of equity in Ramsey County. I think it's important to point out that we, Anoka and Ramsey County, are kind of the last counties to change this. All the other counties, include Scott County, Carver County, already have this model, and so we are looking to them as leaders and examples, and so we would like to move to this model as well.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. Thank you so much for having us here today, and for Representative Newton for introducing this bill to you this afternoon. My name is Julie Jepson. I am an Anoka County Commissioner here with you today, representing the majority of Blaine and all of Spring Lake Park. How do you use your library? I'm hoping you do use your library. During the middle of the night, when I have sleep problems, I wake up and read my library book. On the way down here, I listened to my audiobook on the Libby app. When my kiddos were little, we brought them to the library for story time. Libraries are not just about reading anymore. That's the way we open the door to people, but it serves a lot greater need in our community. And most importantly, what we're seeing a lot right now is that those experiencing homelessness use our library systems as a safe, warm place to be when they need help the most. Current law dates back decades and does not reflect how counties operate our library systems today. In general, counties act as a service center, connecting all people in our community with many aspects of county government. House File 2161 mirrors legislation currently, as my colleague mentioned, in Dakota, Scott, Carver, Washington, and Hennepin counties. Anoka and Ramsey are the only two remaining metro counties using the antiquated system of a library board to operate. I'm here today respectfully asking for your help in making Anoka and Ramsey County libraries more efficient in how they're run, more effective in helping the lives of those in our community, and fully integrating the offered services into our county's operations. Because the library board model was established in state statute, we need you as lawmakers to make the change from a library board to an advisory committee. An advisory committee would allow all nine of our libraries to use many county services such as facilities management, finance, risk management, all of which would bring cost savings to libraries and eliminate duplicative services that would save libraries time and money, allowing us to spend those valuable resources elsewhere within the library system. As a result of the statutory update, the advisory committee and the county boards will be able to work together in harmony, delivering vital services to the residents in our communities. Thank you so much for the time you've allowed us to speak today, and for your and thank you in advance for your future support of House File 2161.
Thank you both, commissioners. I appreciate your testimony today. There are no amendments to the bill.
There are no amendments, Madam Chair.
All right, we can then, is there anyone from the public who wishes to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Members, is there any discussion to this bill? Oh, Representative Nadeau.
I'm not going to speak on every bill today, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We have a full agenda.
Yes, no. But I didn't realize that you guys didn't have a similar board structure as Hennepin does, and it functions well. I'm glad that you're moving it forward. I'm happy to support your bill, and good luck, because it also has different challenges. So thank you for bringing it, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Any further discussion? Okay. Seeing none, would you like to close up on your bill, Representative?
Yes, Madam Chair, and with all respect, I'd like to ask Lee Nash and you if we could move this to the consent agenda.
And talk offline. Do we need to do that now?
It would need to be done at committee now.
Mm-hmm. I ask, Madam Chair, because this is, you know, simply doing what the other counties are already doing. It's nothing new, and I don't see any controversy here.
Well, then, Madam Chair, I guess we would need to make the initial introduction of the bill different. It would have to go to a referral to the general register, and then you and I would have to agree to have it sent to the consent calendar, I believe, if Mr. Gearing, because this is now twice we've done this.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not opposed to it, given that Carver County is already doing this, and as we know, everybody looks to Carver County for great ideas.
There is no motion currently on, because the bill was going to be laid over, there is no motion. So we could make a motion to move it to the general register with the recommendation to the consent agenda. That would be the motion, is that correct? It's up to you, Lead Nash.
Madam Chair, I would consent to that.
All right. Members, we have a motion before us to move House File 2161 to the general register with the recommendation that it be placed on the consent agenda. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposition? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and House File 2161 is going to the general register with a recommendation for the consent agenda. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much.
The next bill we have before us, do you want to continue and do this bill, or should we move to Representative Ryan?
I'm prepared to move with this bill, if you'd like, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay, if we will just do House File 1800, Representative Newton. And again, it is my understanding that this bill is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. I understand you have an A2 amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. The A2, maybe I should explain the bill a little bit first. House File 1800 provides that if the Senate does not reject a gubernatorial appointment within 60 legislative days, the Senate has in fact consented to the appointment. In our HR classes that preceded this legislative session, we discussed the need for a high degree of civility and courtesy in our dealings with one another, the administration, and the public. To hold an appointee in limbo for more than 1, 2, 3, or 4 years is not the type of civility, courtesy, or common decency that reflects well on the Minnesota State Senate. This bill retains the Senate's authority to advise and consent to appointees. However, it must do so in a more respectful, timely fashion. And so that is the bill, Madam Chair. And the amendment, the A2 amendment, provides that no person shall serve as a permanent commissioner or acting commissioner after the Senate has voted to refuse consent to that person's appointment during the same Senate term. So during that 4-year Senate term or 2-year Senate term, the governor cannot come back and reappoint someone who's been denied appointment or appoint that person to another position. And that is my bill, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you very much. Is there any discussion to the the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposition?
No.
Hearing one, the motion prevails, and the A2 is adopted. Next, we have an A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, that would be mine.
Lead Nash to the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, as much as it pains me to say nice things about the Senate, I do believe that they, in both majorities, years of Republicans and Democrats, that they have gotten this right. I don't believe that we need to drastically change it, but I think that if after 60 days of legislative inactivity by the Senate, that rather than automatically be confirmed, it should be rejected, and I would request a roll call on the A1.
A roll call has been requested. Is there any discussion to the A1? Representative?
Madam Chair, I do not support the A1 amendment. When I first saw it, I thought it was a good idea, but after reading it more carefully, it is not a good idea.
Thank you, Representative Newton. A roll call has been requested. I'm just looking to make sure we have still enough people to vote. Okay, if you'll please take the roll.
Chair Cleavorn.
No.
Chair Cleavorn, no. Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Hewitt, no. Representative Nash.
Aye.
Representative Nash, aye. Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Bonner, no. Representative Berg.
No.
Representative Berg, no. Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Freiberg, no. Representative Joy.
Aye.
Representative Joy, aye. Representative Kosnick. Representative Nadeau.
Yes.
Representative Nadeau, aye. Representative Newton.
No.
Representative Newton, no. The noes are 6, the ayes are 3.
With 3 ayes, 6 nays, the motion does not prevail and the A1 is not adopted. Representative Newton, to the bill as amended, do you have any further comments?
I have no further comments unless we have some questions from members.
Okay, is there anyone in the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Any discussion? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Newton. This is a big shift. You know, I mean, there's a power that the Senate has given in statute to make these, you know, if I recall the language is not to reject, it's to advise and consent. And it's permissive. And if the Senate decides that they don't want to take that, then you know, that confirmation isn't there. And I just worry if we try to take power from the Senate when they, you know, what if they try to take power from the House? And I'm not sure that this is a good idea just on its face. I don't know if it's a a good move moving forward at all. If we don't like what the other body is doing, we're going to start, you know, removing its powers just because we have the majority and we have the ability to do so. You know, in the long run, I think that might be a really bad thing for, you know, for our government and for how these bodies work together. And I understand the frustration that, you know, that we all have. You know, yesterday we had a bill in here where, you know, where we all voted to, you know, make sure that, you know, political powers couldn't remove an ombudsman. You know, and everybody kind of agreed to that. And that was a good idea. You know, I think when we get into issues like this, it's, I would never insinuate that this is a knee-jerk reaction by you or anyone else. I just think this, I just think this is not well, I just disagree, I guess. That's it. I'll just say I disagree. So, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you for being agreeable as you disagree.
We have two more questions. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Newton. I don't see this at that level at all, Representative Nadeau. I'm pretty frustrated with what we've been through the last 4 years since I've been in the House. When you're trying to work with a commissioner and they don't know if they're going to have a job the next morning because the Senate might be upset with them or things might not be going okay. And I that is extremely frustrating as you're moving bills through and trying to get things done. I think this just holds the Senate accountable to do their job, either give them a thumbs down or thumbs no and move on, and gives them that time frame. So I think this is a great bill, and it's good to be brought by a former senator, actually, in this case. So.
Lead Nash.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the public watching, what happens now is if a Senate confirmation is not heard or held, that commissioner, for example, is actually continued in their work. They, many of them have worked for years at a time during the administration without confirmation, and I think what this is doing is it's removing a tool from the toolkit of the Senate. And I find that while he is a recovering senator, I do find that that is somewhat alarming, that he would want to strip his former colleagues of some of the things that they have at their command. I think that when this was put into motion years ago, and I believe this is the case for, I can't speak for the other 49 states and then their Senates, because I barely pay attention to the Senate sometimes, but I do believe that this is a valuable tool, and I think that this is a fairly aggressive change, to Representative Nadeau's point, wrapped up in a benign presentation about it being a minor change. I do not think that by simply saying, if after 60 days of legislative inactivity, we're going to confirm them, I think that that takes the voices of the senators that have been elected by the people that they represent to advise, consent, and confirm that particular commissioner. So I am opposed to this. Madam Chair, this is being laid over, or is this being?
It's okay, laid over.
So I can't roll call that. But I do believe that this is a very misguided effort, and I would oppose it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would just like to remind the public that in order for this change to occur, the Senate would also have to agree to this change. It cannot be done, the House imposing solely on the Senate. For a bill to become law, it must pass both bodies with identical language. So with that, I'll ask you, Representative Newton, would you like to wrap up your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you. And thank you for the comments. This bill has actually passed the Senate State Government Committee and will be going to the floor in the Senate. And I'd just like to remind you that, generally speaking, 60 calendar day, or 60 legislative days is roughly a year. So, and if we can't act within a year on an appointment, I think that it makes us all look bad, the Senate, as well as other members of the state legislature. So when it does get to the floor, I encourage your support. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Newton. And with that, House File 1800 is laid over for, as amended, is laid over with, for possible inclusion. Representative, our Chair Becker-Finn, welcome back to the committee. We have before us House File 922, and I will make a motion that House File 922 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Is that correct?
Yep.
The bill is now before us. If you'd like to speak to the bill, please.
All right. Thank you. And I do have one testifier here, but we'll keep it brief. I know how busy everybody is. So a couple years ago, we passed a bill that allowed parents who can't afford an attorney in child protection matters that they can have. They have a right to an attorney. This is like phase two of that and is setting up a statewide office of appellate counsel for parents. So the reason we're here before you is because we're setting up this separate independent office. Obviously, the independence of this office is really important. We didn't want it to be overseen by the courts and, you know, just to maintain the integrity of the system, and that's really what it does. There's more details. It would also hire some folks and make sure that we have ability to train as well.
Right, thank you. Would you like your testifier to come
sure.
forward now? Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and please begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Joanna Woolman. I'm a professor of law at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law and the director of the Institute to Transform Child Protection there. I have been representing parents in child protection cases in Minnesota for almost 20 years, including cases on appeal from district court. There's currently no centralized mechanism to provide appellate representation for parents in child protection cases or to provide essential training for attorneys who handle these complex cases. And for that reason, a new state agency must be created to ensure access to appellate attorneys and training for district court, tribal, and appellate cases. Many other states utilize a centralized office to handle appellate representation and training, and families in Minnesota would benefit, including our tribal communities, from this office and oversight. Minnesota's appellate courts provide important oversight in the termination of parental rights cases, which are considered by many the civil equivalent of the criminal death penalty, because these cases can result in the permanent severance of a relationship between a parent and their children. Appellate courts ensure proper and fair application of the laws. They are courts that are able to remedy errors in cases that may have resulted in the improper termination of parental rights. They also provide important, vital future guidance for district courts and tribal courts, so that attorneys around the state understand that what due process rights are and that those rights are protected for all parties. They protect against needless errors and harm that can occur at the district court level. Appeals are additionally an effective tool for reducing system disparities in Minnesota. And as we know, our child protection system is plagued with disparities. Data from the Minnesota Department of Human Services shows that American Indian, Black, Hispanic, and children with two or more races are more likely to enter foster care and have their parents' rights terminated, and less likely than their white peers to be adopted. Most families who enter our child welfare system also live in poverty. This bill is a critical step to improving the way that we handle appeals and training for parent attorneys and families in Minnesota, and I encourage you to pass this bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to testify on behalf or in opposition to this bill? Okay, seeing, yes, if you'll please come forward. If we could please make room. Thank you. Thank you. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, so I am Soslin, S-O-S-L-E-N. I just want to tell you that I think we have a judicial process for a reason, and I think that this is another way of expanding the department, Justice Department. And we have a Fifth Amendment, and parents are obligated to utilize that, a public defender or something for a specific reason, not just politicize it. And I think this bill is politicizing because previously it was brought up like people of color and injustice. I mean, there's a public defender for a reason. I think this is, I'm against it because this is expanding the department, and I think Minnesota does not need that, especially when you're dealing with kids. Keep it simple.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate hearing from you. Is there anyone else from the public? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Any discussion? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative. I think this is, you know, Hennepin has done this for a while. I mean, this is, and it's super costly. So, and I appreciate the fiscal note, and I just got it. I was looking for it this morning, and I couldn't find it, but it's in the packet. And I appreciate that. So I'm going to try to go through here as quickly as I can with questions and concerns. So I see in the notes that it's about 94 appellate juvenile protection cases were filed in the Court of Appeals. And the funding for this looks like it will fund roughly maybe 75% of that. And so what are you assuming, who is going to cover the cost of the remaining 25% that this bill doesn't fund?
Chair Becker-Fenn.
Thank you, Chair. Again, you know, we just got the fiscal note. The fiscal cost will be before us in the Judiciary Committee, but not everyone would qualify for this appellate counsel through here. This is people who otherwise can't afford an attorney.
Okay. So let's just say
Representative Nadeau.
Sorry, Madam Chair. So let's just say 25% of them can afford it, and that's fantastic. So another reason that I could support this is it theoretically should be a tax reduction in Hennepin County. I mean, we will need to supply fewer lawyers in Hennepin County because the state is going to pick up that bill. Is that fair to assume?
Chair Becker-Fenn.
So one thing I'll note with fiscal notes, they generally aren't as expansive to all the different ways there may be cost savings in different places. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that some of the services that are happening under this appellate counsel process and this parent counsel process, there are reimbursable funds from the feds that are available for some parts of this. So it's it is kind of complicated. There's all these different funding streams. We want to make sure that parents in any part of the state, not just Hennepin County, have access to counsel when they're facing the loss of their parental rights.
And yeah. Representative Nadeau, if you can keep your comments and questions really to the authority of the committee, if you want to request a local impact note, you can do that as well. Are there questions that you have that pertain to the makeup of the... Well, we're not taxes, and we're not. Please go ahead. I'll just let
thank
it
you. So my last question, and you alluded to it, is: do we have data? I mean, this has 94 statewide. It looks like. Do we have data on by county? Because there's a huge connection between child protection cases filed and the counties that they're filed in. So. I'm wondering, do we need a statewide office to do this, number one? Should it be more of a, you know, should we focus resources in counties that need those resources rather than just having, you know, creating a new office? And if you've thought about that.
Chair Becker-Fenn.
So one thing I think is important is that the number, it's also really hard to track this because we don't know who isn't applying because they don't have an attorney and they don't have a way to adequately appeal a decision. There's also a very strict timeline where if folks don't file for that appeal right away, they lose the opportunity. Whereas if we had this office and people were trained, it's just really hard to say what those numbers for sure are because we just started tracking this as of, you know, the original bill went into effect January 1st of this year. But my testifier may have some notes on county to county differences.
Again, so, if you'll state your name for the record and then answer the question. Thank you.
Thank you. That data does exist. We've gone through and looked at it, and I can get that data to you. I don't have it right now, but we can break down how many appeals there are in different counties. I think it's important to recognize that one of the problems that we're trying to address is that right now there are not attorneys in every county who handle these kinds of cases. And so because in January the law changed and now counties are required, they're mandated by statute to provide attorneys to all indigent parents, I'm concerned, and I think this bill addresses the concern that there are going to be counties who can't do that because there are simply no lawyers there. So one of the goals of centralizing that is that attorneys working in the metro area would be able to work on cases in different jurisdictions, and that would be really helpful in terms of providing attorneys around the state, because lack of attorneys in rural counties is a huge problem.
Thank you, Ms. Woolman.
Yep, and thank you. And my final comment, and thank you for that.
Representative Nadeau, please proceed.
And that's my final concern, is that I'm looking at the assumptions that, you know, appellate work is incredibly specialized. There's not a lot of people that do it. It's very expensive. I think you're going to find it difficult to get attorneys to work for these amounts that are put in this fiscal note. And I think that they're even less going to want to travel in order to do that. So I support your bill. I think this is, I think this is a good thing. I just think that there's, that we need to think harder about how we're going to utilize these resources. I know that my county is really good at pulling down federal funds for this. I'm not sure that other counties are. So there's going to be administrative type work that's going to be needed to help them pull those dollars down. I just don't think it's as simple, and I think it's going to be a lot more costly than $3.1 million. I think it's going to be far exceed that. But that's my, and I'll stop. I support your bill. I just think that this fiscal note doesn't even come close to what the cost is going to take.
But Representative Nadeau, I appreciate your line of question. I think it's a good one. It's such an important issue that I think it's important that it be vetted properly. Chair Becker-Fenn.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. And I think part of it, too, is a lot of the feedback we had with kind of phase one was that putting that onus on the counties and the extra, like, efforts and work and costs that are part of that. And so we were really intentional in doing it this way so that it's the same level of training statewide. And so we aren't pushing that on to counties, recognizing that especially our rural counties may not be able to afford to set something up independently.
Thank you. And Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. parental rights are very important, and I think that many times, particularly in child protective cases, whether they're valid or sometimes they are used capriciously as a weaponized tool against people that don't like one another. I've heard prominent cases in my own county. Parents need representation, and I do support the effort, and I know that it was supported in judiciary as well. I'm just not crazy about creating a whole new state agency, and that should come as a surprise to zero people in this room. But I do think that there is a need here. Mm-hmm. I know, I mean, having effectively become helpless to try to represent yourself in the potential loss of your children, that's big. And we should talk about that. I would rather it roll into an existing agency, where some of the overhead costs would be carried by that existing agency. And I would love to hear the rationale as to how you got to let's create something new, because there are going to be operational costs that go in with this new agency that I think I would love to know how we arrived at this, if we could, Madam Chair.
Chair Becker-Fenn.
Yeah, thank you. And I think it's a valid question. This is the first bill I've carried in 7 years here that sets up a whole new thing like this. I think the thing to keep in mind is that in a lot of these cases, they're complicated. These aren't like family law matters. These are CHIPS, juvenile protection, you know, child protection level cases. And I mean, the short answer is that no one else wants to do this. But the more nuanced answer is also you might have a public defender who's representing someone else in this case already. You might have a county attorney representing someone else in this case already. And then you have the courts. You know, I suppose you could make the argument that we could push this into civil legal services, but they also don't have a statewide office. They're separate satellites doing work throughout the state. So we really wanted to make sure we were consistent so that all parents, no matter where you live in the state, have access to the same level of counsel. So I get it, but I think it is also very important that the independence is there, because if you're a parent who's forced with kind of going up against the system, if it were under the courts, I think it's incredibly important that this be independent from the courts and from these other entities so that you have the faith that they're really here to represent you and no other piece in the system.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do understand that. Again, my concern is I don't know that I agree with Representative Nadeau. This may not be an accurate fiscal number because you're creating something brand new. And those overhead operational costs that are the jurisdiction of this committee were largely undefined, perhaps. So I guess my question is, and I am confused because I think the initial referral was to Ways and Means, but in talking to Chair Becker-Fenn yesterday, I believe this was going back to your committee to discuss now the emergence of the fiscal note, because I do believe that your committee hasn't had the chance to deal with that. So I would just like clarification on that, if we could.
So we can make a motion to reconsider the motion?
No, we don't
need to.
Madam Chair, if I could explain. As a chair, my goal is always to have as many options available as possible. And we do have the fiscal note. It will be a big surprise. I'm going to put this in my omnibus bill. So it will be discussed fully at that point. But originally the plan was to send it back to Judiciary to await the fiscal note in case there was something that I felt needed to be changed once I got the fiscal note. But since that isn't the case, we're sending it to Ways and Means.
Thank you for that explanation. I appreciate it. Anything else? Any further questions, comments? I will just, before you close, I'll just say thank you as a former CHIPS guardian. I know how important this is, and to see parents in those hearings when they have lost their parental rights is heartbreaking. And to know that they would have an independent remedy is helpful. So with that, I'll ask you to close up your bill.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. And I think to add on to what you just said, it continues to be heartbreaking for people who have lost their rights. And this, you can't get them back. Mm-mm. And so I think that really is why it's this level of important and why we're bringing this forward. So just really appreciate the discussion and would appreciate your support.
Thank you. And with that, I then will renew my motion to re-refer House File 922 to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion prevails, and you are on your way to Ways and Means. Okay. Representative Ryer. Welcome to the committee. Representative Ryer, and it is our intention to lay House File 749 over for possible inclusion. If you would like to tell us about the bill or do the DE.
Madam Chair, let's do the DE.
Okay. Members, we have a DE before us. Would you like to speak to the DE, Representative Ryer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we could just approve it, and then I'll explain it as part of the bill.
Okay, I move that the House File 749 with the DE1 be amended with the DE1. All those in favor?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I believe it is customary for an amendment to be explained before it's engrossed into the bill.
When it's a DE, it is the bill, right? So if we can put the bill in the order that the author would like first, and then we can discuss it. It's a delete everything. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
With one, the motion prevails and the DE is adopted. Representative Ryer, to the DE, please. Or to your 749 as amended, please.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. Thank you, committee members. House File 749 adds climate change resilience guidelines to the state's sustainable building guidelines, and now has been amended to include the recommendations from the recent Office of the Legislative Auditor report on sustainable infrastructure. The first part, the sustainability guidelines are a set of requirements that apply to all building projects that receive state bond funds. In statute, a process is outlined to periodically review and update the guidelines. And you'll hear more about from our testifiers about the rationale for and the direction of this current round of updates. However, I'd like to set the stage by highlighting the need. We're seeing increases in extreme weather events, flooding, and wildfires. Minnesota has become warmer and wetter, and the risks to our built infrastructure are rising accordingly. We have the opportunity to move forward responsibly by putting guidelines in place that anticipate and address these risks. Now, regarding the OLA's recommendations. As you know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor issued an evaluation report about the sustainable building guidelines in February. Many improvement opportunities were identified, and the OLA recommendations are included in the amendment. Broadly, these covered assigning responsibility to one agency and codifying its duties, clarifying roles and responsibilities, providing training, and providing support to project team members, determining which projects are subject to the guidelines, and determining when and if waivers are permissible. And then finally, monitoring compliance, gathering data, setting goals, and evaluating outcomes. We're still finalizing details with the Department of Administration. I expect it to change at least a little bit after being laid over, but I'm very encouraged by the progress we've made. So now I'd like to turn it over to a testifier to talk more about the bill, in particular the first part about the sustainability guidelines. Thank you.
Thank you. I do not have the name of your testifier listed, so.
Oh, Professor Richard Graves.
Thank you, Dr. Graves. If you'll please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Richard Graves. I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. The center provides technical assistance to the Departments of Administration and Commerce for the sustainable building guidelines, and we work with project teams to support their work on state-funded projects. The bill would expand the Minnesota Sustainable Building Guidelines to include resilience with sustainability as a goal for the guidelines. And for clarification, sustainability is the ability of a building and its occupants to impact or benefit the environment, social, and economic factors in its construction and operations. Adding resilience to the goals would promote and benefit buildings' abilities to respond, absorb, adapt to, and recover from different types of disruptive events. In 2018, the center did a study for Minnesota Pollution Control to look at how could we integrate resilience into the sustainable building guidelines. And that study found a lot of the sustainability requirements already had some resilience benefits, things like energy efficiency, providing renewable energy, things like that, provide both sustainability and resilience benefits. However, what the study found is that because of statute, anything that was resilience only and we couldn't tie to sustainability couldn't be integrated into the guidelines. So this bill would allow some of those guidelines that are resilience only to be integrated into the guideline system. And this would, some examples of this would be having a resilience planning process to work with a resilience tool we've created for all the counties around Minnesota to look at potential hazards and risks to projects and how to plan for those could be integrated into projects. Site and water design issues to plan for and respond to potential flooding. Additional energy efficiency measures to think about future climate files and other factors there. Indoor environmental quality issues, designing for passive survivability and thinking about upgrading the insulation levels in buildings so that the temperatures could hold in those buildings if power was disconnected during a cold spell or a hot times in the summer. And then also considering fortified standards to increase resistance to severe weather for the construction of state-funded projects that could have a benefit of lowering insurance rates for some projects and institutions. So with that, I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Graves. Anything more you'd like to say before we go to discussion?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, are there any other members of the public who wish to testify? Mr. Wozlaski, you'll come forward. If you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Wayne Wozlaski, I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Administration, and appreciate Representative Ryer's work on this bill. We do have some questions and look forward to working with Representative Ryer to work through those questions and possible modifications to the bill.
Okay, thank you. I'll appreciate working with you on that as well.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Is there any other member from the public that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Right, Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either Madam Chair or to the author, the fiscal note is drafted to the initial engrossment of the bill, not to the DE that was timestamped a couple days ago. And the fiscal note was generated on February 3rd of this year. Seems to be more expansive, and some of the numbers seem to be different in the DE. Do we have an updated fiscal note?
Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I was not aware of this DE amendment, so I'll have to request an updated fiscal note.
Thank you very much. We'd appreciate that, and it is being laid over. So, further question, Representative Nash?
I'll wait till we potentially engross it into your omnibus bill, and we'll have a much fuller discussion.
Thank you. Okay. Any other? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Ryer. I only want to add one part, and I think this is once again, I think it's a interesting approach. I'm always concerned when we kind of ignore private industry. I think that private industry is innovating all the time. I think that they are developing those things that the center is evaluating. I think they work hand in hand, and maybe it's redundant that I'm even bringing that up. But it just seems like our lack of trust in private industry is profound in this bill. You know, there's another part of building. There's a lot of parts in building, but one of the parts is cost. I mean, we could build the most resistant building in the world. We'll put 6-foot concrete reinforced, you know, steel reinforced walls. We'll put it on a floating bed of, you know, railroad ballast so that it can float and, you know, do whatever. But number one, nobody wanted to live in it, and nobody could afford to build it. So I don't see one thing in your bill that has to do with cost effectiveness. And we're talking about mandating all state buildings that are going to have to go through this thing. And I mean, the sustainability part is great, and I appreciate the testifier talking about the differences between resiliency and sustainability, and I'm looking forward to having more conversations, because it seems that most of those things are tied together. So maybe I'm worried about nothing, resiliency and sustainability. But I would implore that you add a component for cost effectiveness, and recognizing that the more difficult we make our standards, the more difficult it is for smaller contractors, emerging contractors, people that are starting in the industry to be able to participate. I will always fight for small businesses, no matter where I am, and the more rigid the guidelines, the more difficult it is for them to participate. So with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I didn't really hear a question there, but I would just say there are many of us at this table who advocate for small business. So, Representative Kosnick.
I welcome you.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ryer, I noticed that on line 2.8, we took out the achieving the lowest possible lifetime cost, but then on 2.23, you want to achieve the lowest possible lifetime cost. Can you talk, similar to Representative Nadeau's concern, how the difference between the lowest possible lifetime cost works with the initial cost of building it up front, and how they interact?
Representative Ryer, Mr. Graves, you're coming forward. Please again state your name for the record and then proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Richard Graves again, Center for Sustainable Building Research. the question about cost, lifetime cost, and cost effectiveness is a complicated question. Within the bill, with the SB 2030 part of the guidelines, which relates to carbon, energy, and energy efficiency, there is language in statute that needs to be pursued and researched to think about cost effectiveness there. And our team has worked through a methodology on how to do that and how to get that to design teams. So when they're considering measures, right now they have to figure out how those measures would have a 12-year payback. The challenge on having cost effectiveness in the broader sustainability guidelines is that many of the items have either indirect benefits or not necessarily direct financial benefits, like the energy efficiency items. So that's just a challenge to create a methodology for investing something on the capital side, and what are you going to get for an indirect benefit on the other side, and trying to quantify that. We try to do that as much as we can when we update guidelines and figure out what we should be recommending going forward, both for the guideline itself, but we also work with design teams to figure out what's it going to cost for them to implement guidelines. But for some aspects, it's just really difficult to develop a cost-effectiveness methodology for some of the broader sustainability items.
Thank you, Mr. Griggs. Representative Klasnick.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that it's kind of complex when you're trying to determine, you know, the lifetime possible lowest lifetime cost and then the actual cost to build. Representative Hansen and I happen to be, and Representative Berg are from Dakota County. I was just trying to look. I can't remember which building it is. Oh, and the vice chair as well. Well, good. Then we should all, more of us should share the concern.
And Representative Ryer.
Yeah, we're overwhelmed here.
Well, we'll get Dakota County to, I couldn't find it right now, but one of their buildings that they're building right now had to have some of these efficiencies built into their, supposed efficiencies built into, I can't remember if it's what the building is that they're doing right now, but the lifetime cost of recovering these additional costs to build exceeds the effective life of the material. So you're never going to realize the actual savings, and in fact, it's even long-term lifetime. It's longer, and it's more to build, significantly more, and I'll share that with the members from Dakota County. I couldn't find it right here, but I think that's what the concern is, that Representative Nadeau and some of the public had responded. So we can try to do things that sound good, feel good, but when we're talking about the cost, it's significantly exorbitant to taxpayers who are ultimately funding this, and that's why there should be a concern, and maybe we should pause. Representative Nash talked about the fiscal note, and I'll be curious to see what the difference is. It's got to be increased from what we have here, and that should be a concern. I'm not sure, Madam Chair, I don't envy your job of putting together an omnibus bill when we don't quite know what we don't even know what your target is. I'm sure maybe you have it. You have an idea, perhaps.
I have no crystal ball.
No crystal ball yet. But hopefully your target is ginormous, because some of these bills, when we don't know, I think we're going to be surprised at the cost of them. This particular cost to this provision would be included in that. I appreciate what we're trying to do is be as responsible and sustainable as we can, but sometimes we kind of get out over our skis, and we'll see what the cost is, but that definitely needs to be noted. That is a concern, and we have concrete examples just in Dakota County, and I'm sure we can go throughout other new projects throughout the state that have experienced similar taxpayer embarrassments.
Thank you, Representative Klasnick. Is there any further discussion? Representative Burr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the author for bringing this forward. This has been a great and thoughtful discussion. I impugn no one with these remarks. My concern is that we don't have time left with what's happening currently with our climate to not take relatively immediate action. And I think with the creation of the Sustainable Infrastructure Committee, with the bill that I brought forward just the other day that we all discussed about EPDs and studies to using sustainable materials as we move forward building, these are all ways that we don't get to Representative Nadeau's dystopian home or building where we're surrounded by concrete and floating down some sort of terrible Arctic river, right? These are the things we can do right now to negate that. Also, I think that there's a deliberate sort of narrative out there that small businesses won't be able to compete when we bid these out. That's intentional, and it's not always true. And so I just wanted to leave those comments sitting on the table along with the concerns about the cost. Nobody's saying that's not a thing, but also just kind of to put other pieces out there for consideration. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Berg. Any further discussion? I didn't see Representative Joy putting his hand up.
I came back.
Well, Madam Chair, I got to interject here. We were both on the tax committee, and they had, like, good hot food there. But I was a little disappointed when I first got here. But now my concerns have been alleviated with the little basket of goodies here, too.
We have the best committee administrator. I'm just going to throw that
out. Yeah, I was a little panicked, but now, you know, okay. We're good.
We need to go back to our work. Representative Joy.
Madam Chair, I guess I was bouncing back and forth because double booking what it is nowadays. I do see an 825, there's a dot in the fiscal year, and unfortunately I didn't have an amendment for that, otherwise I would have probably brought a $3 amendment to that. Again, it's moving fast and quick, and just things we got to be responsible for and be watching. So when we're taking care of this in these committees.
Representative Joy, I know that you were at another commitment earlier. We've already discussed the fiscal note, and it has been requested, and this bill is being laid over. Okay. So we have plenty of time to address that, and Lead Nash has assured me that he's going to grill me at a later date. So with that, we are going to allow you to please close this bill, and we will lay it over for possible inclusion. Representative Ryer.
Thank you all. I appreciate the comments and the feedback, as always. And, you know, I do take it all in and give everything I hear about a bill consideration and grow and learn from it. So thank you. The part of the bill we haven't really talked about, and I just want to close with, is the piece that I think is really important, and it's about how these are then implemented. And we have a good track ahead of us for improving the way that they get applied, the way they get measured, making sure that we are using this process to be good, responsible stewards of state resources. And so appreciate your consideration of the bill and look forward to you laying it over.
Thank you. And with that, House File 749, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Next, we will move to Representative Hewitt, House File 1750. Lee Nash, do you want me to apologize for getting this bill to you late? It's up to you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. I just want to start off this hearing by saying that House File 1750 was posted later than normal. It was posted in a time that did not allow our minority party to post amendments. And so I just wanted to apologize in public to Lee Nash for that error on my part, and it was my error. So with that, we are going to lay this bill over, and Lead Nash, if you have concerns later, we can address those together.
Madam Chair.
And if, yes.
I'm sorry, it's going to go to Judiciary.
Oh, we don't.
Yep, they got it scheduled for Judiciary this week.
That's not what we were told.
We can bring it back here.
Okay. That's what we'll do. You may make the motion to re-refer it to Judiciary with the understanding that we will see it again. Thank you. If you'll please proceed with House File 1750.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a departmental technical bill that the Vice Chair is always willing to take with grace, hopefully. So, moving forward on that, I would like to make a motion to refer the bill to Judiciary at this point.
All right. All those in, we don't have to do that yet. Excuse me. The bill is before us with the motion for it to go to Judiciary. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill makes changes that the revisor that basically was missed for electric vehicles on the Capitol complex. Removes a census worker apartment access that will be carried in another bill. other stuff with other things with House File 1750 is administrative cleanup for the statutes that make recommendations on policy changes. Administration proposes to include a series of good governance updates and streamline their work to correct obsolete statutes. These changes include correcting technical mistakes related to the State Historical Preservation Office, transferring it to administration in 2018, codifying the Office of Enterprise Sustainability in law, updating the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution status to reflect their relocation to admin, codifying the date changed appeal process currently in rule, updating the fee collected for electrical vehicle charging on the Capitol complex, and cleaning up obsolete reports that no longer are required. Madam Chair, I have an administrative person here today, and if you want more questions or more details, she is here to answer them.
Would you like to testify on behalf of the bill? If you'll state your name for the record and then please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Julie Byrell. I'm the Legislative Director for the Department of Administration. Really appreciate you hearing the bill today on the short timeline. Thank you to Representative Hewitt for authoring the bill, which is Admin's Policy and Technical Bill. You'll see from the various provisions that Representative Hewitt outlined that there's a great breadth of services that Admin provides to state agencies. And I'm going to briefly walk through the bill. So Section 1 codifies an existing rule for the data challenge appeals process at the Department of, or the Data Practices Office, and clarifies that the commissioner can dismiss appeals that do not meet minimum requirements. Section 2 updates admin statutes related to the move of the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution from Bureau of Mediation Services to admin. They came to us in 2019, and we are reflecting that move in statute. Many of the committee members may know OCDR for the good work they do through the Civility Caucus. Section 3 of the bill codifies the Office of Enterprise Sustainability, or OES, which was created by executive order in 2017 to assist agencies in meeting their sustainability goals and avoid energy costs, which I will note OES has tracked over $62 million in avoided costs since 2005. Section 4 updates the electric service fee for electric vehicles to charge on the Capitol complex and moves the section from admin's facility statutes to the parking statutes. Section 5 removes an obsolete report that admin completed and is no longer required to do. Section 6 and 7 correct mistakes and clean up the statutes after the legislatively mandated transfer of the State Historic Preservation Office from the Minnesota Historical Society to admin in 2017, and the Historical Society supports these changes. Section 8 ensures that census enumerators are guaranteed the same access to apartment buildings as candidates. And that concludes my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions that members may have.
Okay. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to member discussion. Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, there was some confusion that went on. I don't think either of us knew that this was going anywhere else, and that was one of the reasons that I initially did not put up much of a stink. But I do have a question on lines 4.5, subdivision, section 3. It is codifying an existence of a new office that was created by executive order. And that's why it should have come here so we could talk about it and have had ample time for our side to prepare for it. So as you and I talked about yesterday, I cannot stop this bill from going wherever you would like it to go. But I do think that given that it was it showed up late and our side did not have a chance to either accurately prepare for its arrival or its discussion or prepare possible amendments that because all of our amendments are always well regarded. I almost kept a straight face there. But this does provide some hurdles for us. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate the chair's willingness to make sure that this comes back because I think that this committee should certainly have a bite at the apple, if you will, to have a very thorough conversation because this has huge portions of it that are well within our jurisdiction that we did not have a chance to appropriately prepare for. So if I understand, you're going to make a motion to refer it back after it's gone to judiciary, or they're going to handle that there in committee, or how are we going to handle that, just so I can get that on the record?
Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, I will be more than happy to make that request when I go before judiciary.
And that is our understanding at this time. And well. Lee Nash, you and I have worked very well together on this committee, and I appreciate your willingness to work with me on this issue again, and I will say publicly I will talk to Chair Becker-Finn about this as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Vice Chair Hewitt, are there any other members who wish to? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kosnick, I didn't see your hand.
I didn't put it up. You were looking the other way. But just briefly, relative to Section 3, not to belabor the point that Representative Lead Nash made, but you had mentioned some cost savings when you were describing Section 3, or the testifier did. If I could hear those again, and then is that going to be those savings? I think your point is that there's going to be savings greater than what it's going to cost to establish the Sustainability Government Operations Office.
Please state your name again for the record and the answer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Julie Byrell at Admin. So the $62 million in avoided energy costs is what OES has tracked since 2005. And that is part of the work that their office does. And so obviously they didn't start until 2017, but there was work that other agencies were already doing within their own agency. And OES assists agencies to try and reduce those energy costs and make energy efficiency improvements so that they can continue to improve their efficiency and lower their operating costs. Currently, OES is funded through an interagency agreement, and so those costs would remain the same if this was codified in law.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And then just one other thing on Subdivision 3, if I could. Subdivision 9, the electric charging, that the commissioner shall require users of charging stations to and electric vehicles to pay a fee as determined by the commissioner. How is that different from current law, and does this affect who's paying for or the recovery cost of setting up chargers around the Capitol complex? Because my understanding is current law is the fee to use a charger is their best estimate to include the actual use of electricity plus to offset the cost to the taxpayers to install those charging stations. Will that be, does this provision change that?
Madam Chair, Julie Byrell, this moves the section from our facility section to the parking statutes. It does slightly modify the electric service fee to cover electricity. And the maintenance of the charging infrastructure is covered by the parking fund generally. And also we have received appropriations from the bonding bill in 2020 to install chargers, and that's where we get funds to do that.
Thank you. Representative Kosnick, is there any follow-up?
I'll let it be at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just one really quick question. It's on line 4.17, 4.18. It's about creating a conservation improvement revolving loan fund in statute. The Office of Energy Security years ago did that. And I'm wondering where the funding, I didn't see an appropriation in here, and I know it's an agency bill, and so is this just authorizing that to be done, and then some appropriation would come later? I recall that we had to create a loan loss reserve fund. I mean, it was a bunch of financial instruments in order to make that happen, and I was just wondering if this is just authorizing this agency to do it.
Madam Chair, That is already existing in law. We have the State Building Energy Conservation Improvement Revolving Loan Program, and that's in those statutes 16B.86 and 16B.87. And that was established in 2021 with funds from the Renewable Development Account. And so the agent or the office is already doing that. We're just including that duty in their statute.
In this new organization.
So this the OES environmental the Office of Enterprise Sustainability already exists, but it's under executive order. So this would put it in law.
Thank you.
So we're not we are starting a new agency, but it already exists in a different under a different format. Is that what I'm hearing you say? I just want to make sure that I understand exactly what it is you just said.
Madam Chair, you're codifying the executive order. So it already exists, and you are affirming the need for the office and putting it in state statute.
Thank you. I just want this in plain language so everybody can understand what we're doing. Thank you for saying that. Any further questions? Okay. Seeing none, we'll close up the bill, and then I'll renew my motion, or you can renew the motion.
Thank you, Chair Cleborn, and thank you, members. We'll have this bill back to us shortly.
And with that, I will renew that House File 1750 be re-referred to Judiciary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
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 All right. The motion does prevail, and House File 1750 is on its way to Judiciary.
Chair Cleborn, you have House File 2843. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. I will move the House File 2843 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Chair Cleborn, your bill is laid over for possible inclusion. To your bill, please.
Right. It's a very simple bill. House File 2843 is a bill that provides general fund appropriation to the Legislative Coordinating Commission to provide translation services for legislative business. And with me today is Michelle Weber from the Legislative Coordinating Commission to speak to the importance of the bill.
Madam Chair, you have an A1 amendment, is that correct?
I do have an A1 amendment.
Would you like to move that now too?
Yes, please. I move the adoption of the A1 amendment, which is the appropriation for the bill.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? The A1 amendment is now adopted. To your testifier, if you could state your name for us, please.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Michelle Weber. I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And the Legislative Coordinating Commission often provides services on the behalf of the entire legislature, and this is one of the activities that we've been asked to look into providing services for. The appropriation that's provided would fund bilingual staff in the Legislative Coordinating Commission that would be available to provide both written and spoken translation services. For legislative member updates that members may be providing in committee meetings and individual meetings with constituents or also during committee hearings. There's also some resources that would be available to contract with the Department of Administration's master contract process for languages that aren't frequently used so that we could leverage that process as well.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we also have an A2 amendment. Who is offering the A2 amendment?
I am. I will withdraw that because Madam Chair graciously had her numbers filled in with her A1 amendment, so thank you.
You don't know how much I thank you, Representative Joy. back to Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Any other questions the members might have?
Is there anybody in the audience that would like to testify on this bill?
Mr. Heller.
Great.
Yes, it is, Mr. Heller. Is it what?
Only because Ms. Weber might want
to. You move on to drugs.
Mr. Heller, if you could state your name for the record and then state your question, please.
Yes, I committee for local government and finance in the House on March 17th. My name is Rick Heller. I'm a white male with a camouflage hat, with a beard, testifying today on the 2843 regarding the LCC funding. Unofficially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled, opponent in Senate file 1311, page 27, for twice exceptional, and the new word being added, striking handicap to be print disabled. So today, I've been following this through the LCC. I sent messages out to three members that were part of that message, as well as the chair, and on. I'm going to pass over her the report on page 14 of the legislature staff working group on accessibility measures report posted in the library blog on January 12th. It mentions $1.4 million. However, for fiscal year 2024 says 828,000, and then for 2025, 760,000, for a total of $1,534,000. So when I look at this current number that you have, it's quite different. I know that this is transition services, but there's nothing that expresses to the public in a chart how that breaks down. It would be important to do that for the public to understand and to follow this. If whoever wanted to speak to this, these differences as well, as she spoke in the LCC meeting on February 7th, and those breakdowns, would that help this process some more? That would let the discretion of the chair for her to yield to the question if you choose to do so.
Well, thank you, Mr. Heller, for your testimony today, and we will take that into consideration. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to address Mr. Heller's comments just briefly. Mr. Heller has sent emails to me. He has mentioned that he had copied me in emails, and Ms. Weber and I are continuing in conversation. The issues that he raises with technology and accessibility are very important to many Minnesotans. And so I'm continuing to work with the Council on Disabilities as well as the Legislative Coordinating Commission on these issues. It's a very important issue he raises. Thank you, Mr. Heller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your hard work in that area. Is there anybody in the audience wishing to testify? Hearing none, seeing none. Members, to you, to discussion. Is Representative Nash the only one? Do you want to go last? Representative Kosnick from Dakota.
Thank you, Vice Chair from Dakota. Just to clarify, the A2, is there a base funding? Where did my A2 go? Is there a base funding established here then too? Because I thought I saw that delete line 8 was on there, but if I could just get clarification on that.
To Ms. Roberts, please. To Ms. Roberts.
I'm sorry, the A1. I referenced his A2.
Ms. Roberts, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, under current law, if there is an appropriation in the second year of the biennium, that becomes the base funding. So the sentence that was establishing base funding was not necessary.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the author. You know, I have been on the same page for a long time. We have people in our state that speak multiple languages that are not the language that we use here at the legislature per se, and we should fix that. I think that we should fix that both in the spoken word, if there's someone that needs testifiers to be translated, if someone needs sign language, that's an important thing. And to Mr. Heller's point, and I have long believed that this is true, we should also make it for people who need online changes, Braille, whatever. The problem with that is that it is a longer process to get there, and it does take a lot of effort. And Ms. Weber was in my office, I think it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. This feels like a very long week for me. But I think that what I would encourage people to do is to remember that this is not something that you just snap your fingers and it happens. This is cumbersome. We have so many different languages that are widely used in the state of Minnesota. This is a great first step forward. And once again, I hate spending money, and we all know that, but this is an effort that I think is something that we should get behind, and I would be supportive of it.
Thank you, Representative
Ash. Chair Cleburne, would you like to renew your motion?
With that, I ask that House File 2843, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion.
House File 2843 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Oh, you're back at the table. Madam Chair, House File 2902, I believe, is your bill. Your bill.
Thank you, and I will ask Ms. The Reviser Ryan Inman, if he's here, to please come. There you are. Hi. To please come forward. House File 2902 is also to be laid over for possible inclusion. That's my motion.
Okay. Chair Cleburne, I have Ways and Means possibly. Would you like to move it to Ways and Means?
Yes, please. We'll move it to Ways and Means. Thank you. That would be the motion.
Thank you. Your bill has been your bill is in consideration to be moved to Ways and Means. And would you like to present your bill now?
Thank you. House File 2902 will provide $14 million appropriation to the Reviser of Statutes to replace the Bill and Administrative Rules drafting system. The appropriation is made available until it's spent. The current system is used by nonpartisan offices within the legislative branch to prepare bills, amendments, resolutions, committee reports, and other official documents used in the legislative process, and to enroll and publish laws and statutes after a bill has been finally enacted. The system is also used by the Reviser of Statutes to provide drafting services to the executive branch agencies in the administrative rulemaking process. This system is very old. It is in dire need of replacement. And to speak to the need is Reviser Ryan Inman. And I ask that you please acknowledge him for his testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, if you could state your name and with your testimony.
Chair Hewitt, members, for the record, my name is Ryan Inman. I am the Reviser of Statutes here at the Minnesota Legislature. I'd like to start by thanking Chair Cleburne for carrying the bill. This has been a long-standing initiative for us, so I'm happy to see it gaining some traction. As Chair Cleburne mentioned, the system that we're using now is old. That alone probably isn't a sufficient reason to junk it, but we're at a point now where some of the software that the system relies on is becoming discontinued or vendors are no longer supporting it. We also have a code base that's very antiquated and was developed by a number of different people over a period of years. So whenever we want to make changes or updates over here, we tend to break something and it falls off on the other side. And so we would like to stop doing that. When the system was developed, it was based on a local or a native hardware model. The cloud didn't exist at the point. The iPhones and iPads that we all rely on to do our work weren't a thing at that point. And so while I don't think we necessarily want to be drafting legislation on our iPhones, the technology has come a long way since we initially brought this system live. And it really does limit our possibilities to serve you long term. And so this request will help do that. Chair Cleburne mentioned the number of things that the system already does. The new system will do all of those things plus more. One of the really important pieces of this will be a workflow for the legislative staff here that will help hopefully squeeze whatever administrative efficiencies we have left out of our processes to get you your bills sooner. But also crucially, it'll include a member portal that'll allow you to both work with each other more seamlessly and with legislative staff as well. So instead of sending emails to Mr. Gehring asking where your bill is, you'll be able to check and work directly with the folks in our office on that as well. So these systems are also really flexible long-term and allow for a more dynamic legislative environment. If you want committee support, you'll be able to do that. If you want floor support, you'll be able to do that. It will support the journal functions and a wide range of other things. These suites are now really robust and allow you to do your work in a more modern way. And so this system should accomplish all of those things.
Thank you, Mr. Inman. And I, for one, really respect your work. It's scary that you knew my name too well. is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify for this is a public meeting? No one's running down. Oh, we do have one. If you could come up and have a seat and state your name and to your testimony.
So I am Saslin Tiemenson. So I like this idea, but I think $14 million is a little bit too much. I think we can, because I like to save money, and if somebody's like, you have $14 million, like that'd be a little bit, a lot of things can go wrong with $14 million, like a lot of mistransparency can go on. I think it could be revised, and I think if this were to get passed, I think it should be a line-by-line item of exactly where it's going instead of just having a gray area of just throwing $14 million, say, hey, well, here you go. Let's update the software system, see what happens. You know, after all, it's our taxpayers. So I think it's got to have proper transparency, and it's got to be more of a line-by-line item of exactly where the expenditures are going, who's being contracted, how much are they going to be contracted through, and that's pretty much it.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah.
Seeing no other testifiers in the audience, I'm going to open it to members' discussion, Madam Chair. I wasn't turned away from you. Representative Kosniak.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Are there, and it might not be appropriate, so I don't want to put you on the spot, or the testifier, or if the author may be a little more comfortable, any other policy adjustments that we can make to help the revisor's office do their job without all the burdens that, and demands that we put on them? Are there other policy adjustments that would also be appropriate? I think the software enhancements are well supported and have would be well used. Some of the discussion, the testimony just previously about how we're handing out the $14 million might bear some consideration, if maybe under a task force or something. But more to the point, I have confidence in the job and the professionalism of the revisor's office, and we put a lot of demands on them, so we really do appreciate that work. But are there other policy adjustments that we can make here in the legislature, at least in the House, to have it be more streamlined? And if the Mr. Inman prefers not to comment, I respect that, but maybe the author can share some thoughts.
Chair Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kosniak, your question's a really good one. There are things that I would like for people to understand what the revisor office is. You hear me refer to the Attorney General's office as the law firm of the state. The revisor's office is the law firm of our body. And this is the tool is that correct? More or less, yeah. And with that, they need modern tools to be able to do their work. Other policy that we could do is to pay their employees as other law firm employees are paid, and to bring up their salaries and to acknowledge the hard work that they do for the state. That would be one thing I would think about. To the public testimony earlier about splitting up the money in smaller chunks, I think Representative Nash or Representative Bonner could probably speak to this better. Sometimes it is more cost effective to be able to place the order in its totality. When you try to piecemeal something and spread the cost out over a longer period of time, you often don't receive the economies of scale that you would get if you could place the order at one time. Those are the things that I think about, but maybe Mr. Inman would have other things that he would like to say.
Mr. Inman?
Chair Hewitt, Representative Kosnick, I would start by saying I'd be remiss if I said the Revisor's Office isn't the only legal services you receive here at the legislature. Both House Research and Senate Counsel also play a crucial role, and we really do work in concert to do the work. As far as things that can be done to make our lives easier, we're here to serve you. And so we're always reluctant to suggest significant policy changes or anything like that might change the work you do. Just like anyone else, there's only so many hours in the day, and so we want to use those efficiently. Hopefully systems like that will help do that. As it relates to breaking up the funding over time, we did discuss this last year as part of the supplemental request. One of the difficulties in funding these over time is that because it's a large-scale project and we're looking at a single vendor solution, they often want to see all of that money up front so they know that they can bring the project to completion and we don't get halfway done and then run out of money. That doesn't say that would be the case here, but they do like having that assurance up front.
Representative Kosnick.
Well, thank you, and I you know, totally respect the professionalism that your office works in. It's incredible the amount that you get done under the time frames and the pressures that the legislature demands on you. So that is, you know, if this new software system helps facilitate that, and I respect that. I think to the author, Mr. Vice Chair, you know, maybe we should have a discussion, or if it's more through the Speaker's office, you know, we are tasking them with an incredibly amount of number of bills that are being offered, and amendments and stuff are part of the process, but the number of bills, many of them are repetitive and that. And I think that's a discussion that we should have as a legislature a little bit more, whether, you know, it's a difficult balance, you know, with our election certificates and to be able to represent our constituents, you know, to limit the number of bills. We try to do that, you know, member by member, but sometimes some particular district might have more requests or something, or members just want to have a different approach to it. But in order to get the job done, you know, if we prioritize some bills and put in a system or policies around that, you know, some priority bills and then other bills that maybe are less priority that would help the Revisor's Office and the legislature function a little bit better. And then also our government affairs partners putting in requests, and maybe we're aware of it or maybe we're not. Those types of things should, in addition, you know, spending money, you know, I think there's a well-founded need here, but we should have some of those policy discussions as well, to make sure that the system is working to best serve Minnesotans.
Representative Kosnick, Representative Plotowski has me in a special therapy class. You're welcome to join. Representative Bonner, you have a comment?
Thank you. And just in deference to the lead, I think you were on the list first. Do you prefer to go first, last?
Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Just want to be respectful. You know, I just wanted to point out that this system has been in place since, I think, the early 2000s. We've made it stretch about 20-some years, which in technology years is like going back to the prehistoric ages, right? And I think Lead Nash would probably agree on that point. And, you know, we have about 5.7 million, I think, at last count, folks in the state of Minnesota. We have a lot more people and, ironically, a lot more bills, right? And yet we have not changed the duration of the legislature's session, which means that we are asking the revisors to continually do more with less, and we continue to put increased pressure on them and to work with tools that are literally about the equivalent of the dinosaur age. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward, Chair Cleavorn, and to the revisor's office. We cannot even begin to be grateful enough for the work that you do every day, the sheer amount of hours that you put in with the tools that you have to try and pull it out for us each and every session. And for that reason, I think we have to do right by our revisor and make sure that they have the tools to continue to do this job if we're going to continue to ask them to do more. We also appreciate that you want to be able to be efficient and hopefully get some time to go home and spend with your own families during the session, not just all of us, as much as you like us. Thanks so much for that.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will say to the testifier that issued some concern around the cost of things, I do understand a lot of the concern. And once again, as a career stingy person, I am always looking at every nickel that we have. But coming from the industry that both Representative Bonner and I come from, enterprise software is not an inexpensive item. And as it relates to some of the software initiatives that our state has undertaken, when we just say, well, we'll figure it out and we have an open-ended appropriation, we wind up spending $100 and something million for a piece of software that didn't work for driver's licenses. This is a commercially available piece of software that is designed for the purpose of doing this around our country. And having had the revisor in my office, I did ask a couple of questions. I know that this is a piece of on-prem software, and I would prefer it to be a SaaS solution. That's just my preference. I think I would imagine that Representative Bonner feels very similarly, because we can get away from some of the OPEX costs of maintaining and supporting on-prem. But I do respect and understand the need also to have it near-prem or near the enterprise, because you do need to be able to access the data quickly. I think that there is a solution, a hybridized solution, to eventually get to, and the revisor did assure me that that is a piece of conversation that they're having. But we do ask a lot of our revisors, and we make Mr. Gehring work a lot in this committee, and I appreciate his professionalism, but I do want to get him better tools. And I want to be able to get the revisor's office tools that reflect the need for members to be able to interact with that piece of software themselves, because that will take some of the pressure off of their plate, because you oftentimes do have emails to say, hey, where is this? You then send it to various people around the enterprise, and after a while, that becomes more work than is it's worth, to be honest. But enterprise software costs money, and good enterprise software is something that has been built, broken, beaten up, repeatedly put on trial in tests, broken again, and then when it's working properly, you then have a piece of software that can be deployed to an enterprise. And this enterprise is substantial. So this is not something like going down to a office supply store, as we've done in the past, and you buy a piece of software off the shelf and you go home and install it yourself. This is nothing like that. So just to level set that, for anybody who's either watching or listening here in the audience, this is not something that you give your Visa card for $39.99. This is not it, and this is an extremely complicated thing that has to cross-reference existing statute and make changes on the fly. So I this is two spending bills that I've supported in one day. That might be noteworthy in and of itself, but I do think this is a worthwhile effort. So thank you.
And thank you, Representative Nash. Those are, it's always great to listen to you in that space. Chair Cleburne, your bill.
Thank you. Members, I do ask for your support as this bill moves forward in the state government larger package. But I also want to acknowledge our House research team, our CA, our researchers, all brilliant lawyers who help us do the work that we do, and to House Fiscal as well. All of our professional nonpartisan staff are amazing. So with that, I ask, I'll renew my motion that House File 2902 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
All those in favor, or Chair Cleveland?
Nope, nope.
What did I do wrong? Nope. Oh, Ways and Means, sorry.
Thank you for
catching up. It was on my script.
I messed up. I will renew my motion that House File 2902 be re-referred to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cleburne. And
see why I say they're excellent?
Yeah. All those in favor of Chair Cleburne's motion to move the bill to Ways and Means signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? The ayes have it. Your bill is on the way to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
One more bill for the Cleburne Day.
About that later. Okay. 1863.
And you're Testifier is making his way to the stand.
Mr. Wenzleski, good to see you.
Chair Cleborn, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Chair Hewitt. House File 1863 is an agency bill from the Department of Administration, and it can contains many changes to laws that are administered by the Department of Administration. Some of those things include streamlining the work of the State Designer Selection Board, clarifying which projects can be used as asset preservation or COPRA funds, allowing the state construction project delays from consultations, avoiding state construction project delays, increasing emergency preparedness, and clarifying state construction contracts that can be negotiated using the best value procurement process. Really, Mr. Wenzleski is the person who can truly speak to this bill and all of the changes, so I would ask you to move to his testimony, please.
Real quickly, you want to lay the bill over, is that correct?
The motion would be to lay it over for possible inclusion, yes. Thank you.
And I see no amendments. So, to the testifier, if you could state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you, Chair Cleborn, for authoring our policy bill and for hearing our bill. I know you're very busy. So for the record, my name is Wayne Wenzleski. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Department of Administration. And I'll just walk through each section of the bill real briefly and then stand for questions. So section one is to minimize potential construction delays. Current law provides for an agency to allow a contractor to proceed with supplemental work within the limits of appropriation before funds are encumbered in the state's accounting system. So if you're thinking of a construction project, it's underway. We don't stop and halt the project to wait to encumber funds if an issue is encountered. What this provision would do is to expand that to allow for design contractors, the design firm or a testing company, to also proceed without waiting for funds to be encumbered. So we can get delayed on our construction projects if some design work is needed once an issue is discovered on a construction site while the accounting pieces step is being done. And so this really is intended to avoid those delays and the associated costs. Section two and three of the bill, this provisions changes, revises our existing statutes for use of asset preservation and CAPRA funds. And it clarifies that asset preservation funds are able to be broadly utilized to preserve state assets as long as the project meets constitutional and other requirements for use of general obligation bonds. And an important to note, this change is really following what our current practice is and has been for quite some times. In recent years, there's been discussions around different interpretations of the authorized uses of asset preservation funds under existing law, and this can result in critical needs being unmet. Most recently, we had an issue and debate about a security fence at the correctional facility up in St. Cloud. Was that it was a new fence? Was that a new improvement, or were we, the statute allows for security improvements, so were we able to proceed with that type of work? And so there was a lot of back and forth involving bond counsel on interpreting the statute. So this is intended to clean up that, to make it real clear that obviously the intent of asset preservation is to take care of our existing assets and make them usable for their intended purpose. So this that provision clarifies that statute. Section four clarifies that this is related to the State Designer Selection Board. Again, the State Designer Selection Boards make selections for design firms for certain levels of projects. This clarifies the projects that go through the State Designer Selection Board. Again, this is clarifying what the existing practice is, so it follows the existing practice. Sections 5 through 7 and Section 10, again, relate to the State Designer Selection Board. These sections would increase the thresholds for projects that go through the State Designer Selection Board from projects with an estimated cost greater than $2 million, or a planning project with estimated fees greater than $200,000, it would change those thresholds to $4 million and $400,000, respectively. These thresholds have not been increased or adjusted for inflation since 1996. If enacted, the thresholds would automatically be adjusted every 5 years based on the rate of inflation moving forward. Association of General Contractors, AIA, Engineers Council, Minnesota State, U of M, and state agencies have all expressed support for this change to the State Designer Selection Board. Section 8, this provision waives the solicitation process in emergencies for design and new construction. In 2005, in response to the avian flu outbreak, the Minnesota legislature appropriated funds in a special session to design and construct a new lab facility. The lack of clear authority was a roadblock to expediting the design and construction process. Each month that passed, significant economic damage was occurring. And lastly, as Section 9, this clarifies the best in value offer solicitation process may not be used for building and construction contracts awarded based on competitive bids. So when we're doing a low bid situation, we can't then go to the low bidder and then ask for another best and final offer. Make sure that it's open and competitive and transparent process. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd stand for any questions.
Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify?
Mr. Chair, I would just like to refer the members to the letter that is in your packet today, dated March 17th, from the American Institute of Architects. It really discusses the last portion of the bill that was sections 5 through 8 of, or 7 of the bill, and the support for that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Seeing no other testifiers, we'll leave it open for member discussions. Representative Netto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question in Section 2. It's Section 2, Subdivision 2D, the last sentence, it's an add. And it's line 3.10 and 3.11. So it talks about an appropriation not being able to use to make a minor emergency repair. And then down in the next, literally just the next section in line 3.17, at 3.14 to 3.18, sorry, it says, then it talks about emergency and unanticipated emergencies. I'm just wondering, it's just confusing to me right there. Can you tell me what the differences are?
Yep. To the chair?
Mr. Wazlowski.
Yeah. Mr. Wazlowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative, really good question. So part of the requirements and tests for using bond funds is they cannot be used for things that are considered maintenance or routine repairs. To be able to use our state bond funds or general obligation bonds, they really, what MMB and Bond Council is looking for it to be a major project. And typically we define that as a project that's more than $50,000 has been our general threshold. So it really what we're trying to do with our funding is you're trying to deal with unmet needs. So those smaller costs, agencies are typically able to absorb or have other funding sources to deal with. This is intended to be when we're actually using bond funds, money that's both significant and it also is, it's a 20-year bond, so you're trying to get to the point where the improvement you're making is gonna have the right level of useful life to meet the test that's out there, both for the constitutional test for using general obligation bonds as well as the IRS requirements for using tax-exempt financing.
Representative Doe.
Thank you. That's my last question.
Any other questions? Representative Kosniak.
Appreciate the presentation and looking at page 7, subdivision 2, the emergency acquisition. The 7.21, the design and construction addition to the emergency powers. I remember the dark days of, I think it was 2019, when we were first facing COVID, and we met very in a bipartisan manner. I think maybe even Representative Hansen, or was it Nelson? Was it you? We tried to talk about how we were going to handle this pandemic, and we weren't sure what was facing us. But one of the requests was to be able to construct. You had mentioned the avian flu epidemic, but my personal experience was with the COVID pandemic onsetting that the administration wanted to be able to construct and build maybe a new hospital, a testing center, that kind of stuff. And I think we have now the luxury of hindsight. And so, Madam Chair, as the author, I would give a good consideration and pause to this part as watching out for taxpayers. We would potentially be on the hook with a variety of new constructed buildings that now that the pandemic has waned, I think we were able to do the best we could during those times. And during that time, I argued against putting into statute design and being able to construct new buildings through the use of emergency powers. And I think the hindsight shows that we were able to reuse different buildings. Fair or unfair, there was criticism of buying that $7 million or $5 million morgue. Luckily, that we didn't need to actually use, and we were able to resell, and that received some criticism. The criticism would have been significantly bigger and more profound if we had to build a $100 million hospital, treatment centers, testing centers, and we were able to figure out other less expensive and less permanent things for short-term emergencies, even though the previous emergency went on for a considerable amount of time. When we construct new things during emergency times, that has lasting, ongoing cost to the state and taxpayers. And so I respectfully oppose that part of this bill and would ask that give it some consideration if you choose to put that into your bill down the road here.
Thank you, and I would just like to address that. I know.
I've been dying to do that.
I know.
Representative Kosnick, thank you.
Yep.
Madam Chair.
I'm so glad we can have some fun in this committee. I'm going to ask Mr. Wozlowski to discuss line 7.25. That's 2.4 and 2.5.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleavorn, so the provision that applies to projects conducted by the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. So this would be in addition. So when we're going through the State Designer Selection Board, they're also going through that provision or through the board. So this would allow both state agencies, and just clarifying that in this case it also would apply to Minnesota State.
Okay. But thank you, Representative Kosnick, for your concern, and we'll work on this together as we go forward.
Are there any other member questions? Seeing none, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Final words?
Thank you, Chair Hewitt. And with that, I would say that House File 1863, the motion would be to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Madam Chair, your bill has been laid over for possible inclusion, and the chair is yours once again.
Thank you very much. You know, I've often said the greatest gift my mother ever gave me was the ability to laugh at myself. This is a good day. Next, we will have on the agenda, welcome to the committee, Representative Jordan. This bill is one of the most interesting bills that we're going to have today. And we are at House File 2408 with Representative Jordan. And it is my understanding that we are going to recommend this to Ways and Means. So with that, I will move that House File 2408 be re-referred to Ways and Means. And to your bill, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I'm back with House File 2408, which would fund a study on the St. Anthony Falls to the tune of $750,000. And this is necessary because there are true and serious concerns about the structural integrity of the cutoff wall that is the basis for the falls itself. And should this wall fail, there could be very serious safety concerns for the city of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and the entire state. I'm going to kick it over to testifiers to really get into some of that. I'm not an engineer. But as a quick history lesson, St. Anthony Falls is the only significant natural waterfall on the Mississippi and has special cultural significance to the Dakota people. And I think we all think of Minneapolis. We think of the nickname the Mill City. That nickname was earned because of all the flour mills that were along the Mississippi River that were powered by the St. Anthony Falls, which was a natural waterfall, and now looks like the manufactured waterfall because it is manufactured. There's a concrete cutoff wall behind the falls that is the basis for the falls. There was significant industry in the mills. There was a number of tunneling that attempted to happen, and we were in real danger of losing the falls themselves because the falls are a result of sandstone, St. Peter's sandstone, which is a very, if you know about sandstone, you know that it's an erodible, it's a gritty kind of material, and it did erode, and we were in real danger. And what people don't realize is a little bit farther upriver, almost to my district, is where that sandstone ends. And so we were in danger of losing the falls altogether, and by we, I mean the Minneapolis of 100 years ago, well over 100 years ago, is in danger of losing the falls, which would have serious implications for the river itself and the bed itself, along with industry. And so the Corps of Engineers built the cutoff wall, or the concrete retaining wall, the curtain, some people call it. There's a number of different names. And that is the basis for the St. Anthony Falls that we see today, right by the Stone Arch Bridge. That wall is the same wall that is well over 100 years old and was constructed by the Corps of Engineers. And so that wall now, while being a icon for the Mississippi River as a whole and that part of Minneapolis as itself, is also important for hydrology. It's important for the it's an electricity generator. It is also, the Mississippi River is also the source of drinking water for everyone in Minneapolis, a number of other suburbs. It's a source of drinking water for many, many, many Minnesotans, and especially it's also the source of water for the airport, the Mall of America, and myself and all of my constituents. And so it's important that we are protecting the St. Anthony Falls to avoid very serious flooding, to avoid serious shortages of water for hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who drink that water. And also just to make sure that our transportation system is intact, that our downtown is able to thrive. So it's also a bit of a finger-pointing expedition, because the St. Anthony Falls has had a lot of people who have jurisdiction over it, including the federal government, the city of Minneapolis, Xcel Energy. And so there's a lot of people who, the University of Minnesota system, so there's a lot of people with interests in making sure that this wall does not crumble. And so this would be a study done by the University of Minnesota to assess the structural integrity of that cutoff wall. And with that, to go into a little bit more on the engineering of it all, I'd like to go to testimony, Madam Chair.
Perfect. We have two individuals who are here to testify. If you would please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Colleen O'Connor-Toberman. I'm the Land Use and Planning Director at Friends of the Mississippi River. HF 2408 presents an important opportunity to address one of the Twin Cities' most neglected and overlooked yet crucial pieces of infrastructure, that cutoff wall that helps hold up St. Anthony Falls. This wall was built by the Army Corps of Engineers in 1876 after a series of mill tunnel collapses undermined the falls area's very fragile geology, creating whirling vortexes of water and endangering surrounding infrastructure. If the cutoff wall or the surrounding geology were to fail again in any way today, this chaotic and dangerous past could be our future as well. The problem is that no one knows who owns that cutoff wall today. Because of this, it hasn't been inspected or maintained in decades. Many geologists have told us that it's very reasonable to assume that river water could be flowing under, over, or even through that wall in a way that could eventually undermine its structural integrity after nearly 150 years in existence. The cutoff wall starts under the riverbed and it runs down 40 feet. It's over 1,800 feet long and it's made of concrete and ranges from 4 to 6.5 feet thick. It's built in the riverbed's highly erodible sandstone layer, as has been mentioned. Above the sandstone is the limestone layer. That's what defines St. Anthony Falls and the River Gorge downstream. The falls carved this gorge over 10,000 years of receding upstream from downtown St. Paul, eroding the sandstone and then collapsing the limestone above it as it went. This limestone layer just happens to end just slightly upstream from where the cutoff wall, the dam spillway, and other structures help cement St. Anthony Falls in place. A failure of any one of these structures could set the falls free to continue that erosive path upstream. All of these structures have a clear ownership and are inspected every 1 to 2 years, except the cutoff wall. So we have reason to be deeply concerned about the condition of this wall, and we have reason to worry about the serious consequences should it fail. As Representative Jordan mentioned, this cutoff wall helps maintain the upstream water levels at Minneapolis's water supply intake. If that wall failed, river levels could drop too low for that intake to work. The city only maintains a three-day reserve. St. Paul's water supply intake is only a few more miles upstream. It could also be endangered. And together, Minneapolis and St. Paul provide water to over 1 million Minnesotans in 15 cities. So imagine our schools, hospitals, fire hydrants, homes, businesses, and the international airport all losing their water within a matter of days. A cutoff wall could failure could also begin the river, prompt the river to begin cutting down the difference between the nearly 50-foot drop between the top and the bottom of the falls. So this geologic activity could very quickly compromise MnDOT's Third Avenue Bridge, which is just feet upstream from the wall. Additional bridges, parks, roads, utilities, homes, and riverfront structures could be compromised as far as 30 miles upstream. So the consequences could be disastrous and costly. This orphan hazard needs our attention. This bill will fund the University of Minnesota's St. Anthony Falls Lab to study the condition of the cutoff wall and surrounding geology and assess potential risks. Based on that research, Hennepin County will be able to conduct a hazard assessment of how to begin protecting our community from those risks. The county's director of emergency management, Eric Waggy, is out of town today, but his written testimony is in your packet. To be clear, we're not saying that the cutoff wall is an imminent failure risk. We don't know, and the problem is that no one else knows either because it's not being inspected or evaluated on any regular schedule. So this bill would fund the initial steps towards addressing that problem and give us enough information to make some informed decisions about how to move forward. Long term, we're likely going to need federal and state involvement to answer the question of the wall's ownership. Right now, we need to act to protect all Minnesotans and all of our public infrastructure that depends on the Mississippi River. I appreciate your interest in this issue and ask you to support the full $750,000 appropriation for HF 2408. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Carrie Jennings. I'm a professional geologist and the research and policy director at Freshwater. Freshwater is a nonprofit that works on preserving our water infrastructure as well as groundwater quality and surface water quality. We have collaborated in the past with Hennepin County Emergency Management on two different hazards projects for the county. One was a precipitation-driven landslide study for the county that is an online atlas. And the other one is a sinkhole assessment for the areas where there's very little of the glacial cover over bedrock. This area, this part of the River Gorge, actually has both of those geologic hazards as well as this vulnerable riverbed. So we support this study to be conducted by the St. Anthony Falls Lab at the University of Minnesota. They actually exist on an island in the river at the falls. They are world known for constructing physical models of dam removal, where it's intentional for the passage of fish. And they could construct a physical model that would help people understand what this process is. If you've gone to the U of M and taken a geology class, you've probably done an exercise that has you tracking the retreat of this waterfall from the Science Museum site downtown all the way up to where it is now. And students will bicycle along the gorge, and each revolution of the bicycle tire is so many thousands of years. So it's the natural course for this waterfall to have moved up. It's a Niagara-sized waterfall that I can vividly imagine in downtown St. Paul, moving up the river, heading up the Mississippi Gorge to where it is now. It would have continued if not for this work, early work from the Corps of Engineers and then repairs in the 60s. And it is likely to continue to degrade and move again. That is the natural course of a dynamic river in a metropolitan area. So I support this study to understand what is going on actually in the riverbed. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone in the public who wants to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while I didn't attend the University of Minnesota for a geography or geology class, I did attend the University of Nebraska and did my graduate work in geography, physical geography, and political geography. And both the sandstone and karsted topography are very porous and are built effectively to erode. Because they're both sedimentary functions. But I guess my question is, we're going to be doing a $750,000 study. Studies always lead to a project, and someone's going to have to pay for the project. If we're still squabbling over who owns the thing, how are we going to figure that out? Because the study is going to be done over a period of time. Once that is done, are we going to bare-knuckle box to figure out who pays for this, or how are we going to do that, I guess?
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, if you couldn't tell, I did take that class at the U of M on the – it was well over a decade, though. And so I appreciate the refresher on it. You know, I don't know the answer to whose job it is, but it is our job to figure that out. I think this study is a good way to look at if there is a real need there. I think we need to move on that, because if I'm very worried that if you know, my constituents would be down to 3 days of water, we would have a very big problem on our hands. But I believe that we can solve that problem about whose job it is to work on this. I certainly think that there is, I have personally been speaking to our federal partners about the need for this. I've been talking to our local partners as well. You can see the letters from Hennepin County and the National Park Service, the City of Minneapolis. We all need to get a handle on this problem before we can solve a problem. I think it's good to figure out the scope of the problem to determine the solution. And so I think this is part of it. I think we have some time to figure out who's in charge, but we need to get a handle on what the scope of the problem is. And I don't know, Colleen, if you have more to add to that, but we need to get a handle on this with the study.
Lead Nash.
Well, again, thank you, Madam Chair. And it's always fun to go back and talk about geology and geography, and it's a nick point, right?
Yeah.
So it is built to erode backwards up the river, and it's a problem. But my concern regarding the bill, Representative, is that I certainly understand trying to assess the problem, but would love to also have in the conversation that we're looking at JPAs, or how do we figure out who's going to do what, when, how do we bring in the feds and the Corps of Engineers, because we can't do this on our own if we don't actually understand who owns it. So we could assess the problem, but if we're not on our own able to fix the problem, then I just feel like the state shouldn't have to pay for that. And my reticence is in, if we're going to appropriate the money, then if no other outside force acts on it, we're going to come back and say, well, now we have to do it because we paid for the study. And that causes me great pause.
And just for the public, the reference to JPA is the Joint Power Agreement. Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my line is on the same wavelength. There's
Would you pull your microphone down just a little closer to you? Thank you.
Close to your mouth. The ownership issue is a problem. And we just, Coon Rapids Dam, you know, went through years and years of trying to figure out who owned it. We finally did get it stabilized. And what I fear in this particular bill is that we're going to go and do some work, which is great. You know, I'm not opposed to that. But we know that the situation and the conditions are going to change by the time we actually begin to do the work. And so this is, while interesting and helpful, it's not going to be relevant, because we're going to have to do it again prior to any construction happening, because it will change. I mean, that's exactly what happened in Coon Rapids. It's exactly what happens in every one of these situations. So unless we identify who owns this, who's going to be responsible, and do it in a timely way, this will be, I fear this money will just be interesting and something to talk about and something for the U to do. And that's the other thing, is I wonder where the U is. Why isn't the U here talking about the scope of work that they're being forced to do? So with that, I think it's, I just think the timing of this is off. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The University of Minnesota supports this bill and is willing and able to do this study.
Representative Joy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is to the author, is that why it's the Board of Regents that's assigned to this? Because they support it, or is, I guess the question is we put in here the general fund of the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. Are they the ones we would appoint this to, or is that why they're the ones in here?
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, my understanding is it's written that way because they're the entity that receives the money. We don't say it's going to Professor Cleborn to do this study. We say it's going to the University of Minnesota Board of Regents because they're the entity that would receive the money.
They would be the fiscal agent to receive the check for payment. Oh, Representative Harder, I'm sorry, couldn't see you.
Over the head.
Please go forward.
Rep. Jordan, thank you. Representative Jordan, thank you. My question is, so we're asking the state for funds on this particular bill. is the county or the city offering funds to on this study?
Representative Jordan.
Madam Chair, not that I'm aware.
Any further question?
I don't have a question. It'd just be nice if there was a collaboration between the three. You know, I think they benefit from it too. So if they provided funds, that would be great.
Thank you so much, Representative Porter. My personal comments, if you don't mind, I think it's a really important project. The idea that it is an orphan project, everyone's going to say it's not mine, so we're just going to ignore it, leaves our state at a tremendous risk. The best outcome of spending $750,000 would be that we would find there's no problem, right? And we can all go to sleep at night not worried about our water supply. I will ask you to then close up the bill, and we will move it, we'll renew our motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just remind people that the city of Minneapolis has a reserve of 3 days of water, fresh water, that we drink and rely on to live. So for me, that's my motivation. That's what keeps me up at night worrying about those 3 days. So I ask for member support for this study. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 2408 be referred to Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2408 is referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Jordan. And with that, we will now move to agency budget requests.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Would a brief recess be in order?
Oh, sure. We can take, what do you want, a five minute recess. Let's come, why don't we say we'll come back at 3:20. We are in recess. Members, I call us back to, I call the State and Local Government Committee back to order. Right. You know who's there. Mr. Morris, would you like to come forward? Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record and the agency that you're representing, and then proceed with your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Andy Morris, and I serve as the Public Affairs and Legislative Liaison at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. Thank you for the opportunity to briefly speak to our council's work and the budget request for the coming biennium. Our council serves a population estimated at 370,000 strong. As of the 2020 census, this community resides in every one of the state's 87 counties, as far north as Baudette and Warroad, and as far south as Marshall and Walnut Grove. As one of the state's three ethnic councils, our council was created to serve as the key advisor to the legislature and the governor, and in doing so, advocate on behalf of these communities within state government. Some specific examples of our council's delivery on our statutory duties from recent years include ensuring a more thorough count of Asian Pacific Minnesotans in the 2020 census by the API Complete Count Committee, assisting Asian Pacific Minnesotan business owners and everyday community members with navigating state government to access pandemic and civil unrest resources, advocating for legislation that addresses important issues as identified by our community, such as gender-based violence prevention, increasing teachers of color, literacy in supporting English learners, and anti-Asian hate, and facilitating the Afghan evacuee roundtable between community leaders, organizations, and state government for 15 months at the request of the Department of Human Services Resettlement Programs Office. For more complete details of the work of our council, I would direct you to our statutorily mandated annual reports. Excuse me. We requested a 14% increase over our current base budget, amounting to $72,000 in fiscal year 24 and $77,000 in fiscal year 25 to cover cost increases, salary adjustments, and to conduct more comprehensive outreach to our communities in greater Minnesota. The governor has recommended an 18% increase for our council, $89,000 in fiscal year 24 and $111,000 in each subsequent year. At the very least, we ask that you support the governor's recommendation to support the work of our council and to maintain our current capacity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. I greatly appreciate the work you do, as I have a large, wonderful Asian ancestry population in my community. So thank you for the great work that you do. Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And full disclosure, I serve on the executive committee of the API board, and I guess for the third time today, I will say that we should probably fund this appropriately. I'm way out over my skis now. Holy moly. But I have accompanied Ms. Herr and other staff from the API board in many different communities, some even in Dakota County, I believe. So it's not just concentrated to one area. It's a great community, and I have learned a ton and have been welcomed warmly and fed profusely. So thank you.
Members, any other question or discussion? Mr. Morris, we thank you for your time today, and thank you for the great work you do for our state.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, if you'd like to come forward. Oh, sorry, Mr. Ladd. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, thank you, members. Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. My name is Neil Ladd, the Deputy Executive Director for the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission and the National Sports Center. I'd like to first start by saying thank you to Representative Newton, who served on the Amateur Sports Commission for many, many years, has seen many, many things come through the doors of the National Sports Center, including the 4.2 million people that visit us every single year. So thank you for your support over the years. I really appreciate it. The Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission is one of the state's smallest state agencies. It oversees a $15 million flagship amateur sports facility called the National Sports Center, and it brings in nearly $90 million of economic impact every single year. Representative Nash, I know you've said your kids have played there before, and we really appreciate, you know, the facility that it is and the support that you've given us over the years. The agency is made up of only three state employees. Roughly 80% of that budget is from state funds. The remaining budget is made up from Hennepin County grant funds that come from the Ballpark Authority. Currently, there's been no commitment by the Hennepin County to renew that funding source, so the MASC is asking for the small appropriation or the small budget increase to retain the three employees and continue to keep the MASC a viable state agency. With that, I'll take any questions.
Okay. Members, are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Madam
Chair, thank you. I would just like to say that this board or this commission really runs on a tight budget. I think it's in the neighborhood of $200,000, if I'm not mistaken. And their economic impact is close to $90 million. So any funding in addition that you might find, Madam Chair, we could have a good place to direct it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative, or Vice Chair Hewitt.
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you. I found a very interesting fact about, and I think, did we visit last year? Yes. So I was looking for a place to park my fine of the unruly fan, which is another story we can get into. But the truth is that the only state agency that controls amateur sports, even the high school league isn't a state agency that cannot levy a fine, are you. And I think we have to embrace you a little bit more because of that. You actually, we don't realize this, but you control it all. And I think we have to dig into that a little bit more and look at what that means, because in my case, what I was looking at that is these fans that are, you know, meet me at my car and stuff like that, and we need to levy a fine, which is a very small revenue source for what we're looking at here. But I really think we have to revisit this and make sure you're well-funded, because we know for a fact that if our children participate in an after-school activity, they do better. They do better in life. They do better then. So we need to look at what we can do to support you to make sure that we can continue this pathway. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could add one more thing. Is
Representative Newton.
One way we could do that is by looking at the bill that I have for the preparation of the roof for solar. Because with the implementation of solar on the ice arena there, that would save the sports center roughly $200 million a year, which would greatly benefit them, and they'd be able to put it to good use. So I'm hoping that we can look at that bill and consider it.
Thank you very much, Representative. Representative Nadeau.
From Hennepin County, you know, thank you. You guys have administered our Hennepin Youth Sports Grants, I think, since the its inception. And I don't know why we're not, I don't understand. I mean, I'm not part of that component anymore. But, you know, just to let the members here know that I want to say we grant out somewhere between $5 and $7.5 million a year, small grants, both facility grants and equipment grants.
Clarification, the we you're referencing is?
Hennepin County.
Thank you.
Any resident of any payer in Hennepin County, this is an over-collection in the ballpark sales tax. It was written into the bill, and it's to provide amateur sports opportunities, and it's everything from soccer fields to backstops, grass, lawn mowers. And there's an enormous number of municipalities and nonprofits that partner and put proposals into the county. And these guys actually do all of the work. They receive all the RFPs. They do all the education in the communities. They do all of the work, and then the county board basically determines, based on their recommendations, which one of those projects get funded. You guys have done incredible work over the years, and I just wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Any further discussion? Lead Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the acknowledgement. The kid is now 26 years old, but it did prepare him for, in part, an excellent collegiate soccer career, and it's a really solid facility. You guys do a nice job. I enjoy attending there, even though it is a very long drive from Oconia, and oftentimes we had to play it. One time we had to play it, I think, 6 a.m. in the middle of summer for the Schwann's Cup, mm-hmm. which is I don't like mornings that much, so. However, it's a very nice facility. The relationships that are built there are really excellent. I know that my son met a lot of friends that he played with, both from his own team, the area, and then I think he met up with a Norwegian guy that came in out of state because we're a Norwegian family. That was obviously interesting, but great facility, and hope we can make something work for you.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And I just want you to know, I think I heard Lead Nash just say he would be supportive of your appropriation.
That's what I heard.
Well, Madam Chair, if you wanted to break a lot of these things out of an omnibus bill, you might get more votes out of my side. But,
thank you so much for your testimony and for the great work you do for our state.
Appreciate
we appreciate it. Next, we have the Minnesota Racing Commission. And members, there is a handout in your packet as well from the Racing Commission. Thank you. Welcome. If you'll state your name for the record and your agency and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. Thank you for the opportunity this afternoon to talk about the item that we have in the governor's budget. Minnesota has a strong horse racing industry, and the Racing Commission plays a critical role in fulfilling its mission of protecting the public interest to ensure the integrity of horse racing and the safety of its both human and equine participants. To fulfill this mission, the Racing Commission is attentive to all aspects of horse racing and card playing, from licensing the tracks, track personnel, and other participants in racing, to ensuring that the rules of the industry are enforced and investigated. We also work to ensure the safety of those involved and the health of animals through the use of our regulatory veterinarians who perform pre-race examinations as well as collect post-race samples for testing for illicit substances. We also are involved in putting money back into the industry through distributing awards from the Minnesota Breeders Fund, and also just recently we distributed about $200,000 in grants to retired racehorse aftercare. The Racing Commission rarely comes before the legislature to ask for general fund money. Instead, we're funded generally entirely by the industry that we regulate, and that is through license fees, regulatory reimbursements from the tracks, as well as a fee that we receive from online advanced deposit wagering on horse racing. However, due to the cost of complying with new federal regulations, we're asking for a one-time $1 million appropriation in the governor's budget. Now, one of the most significant topics of discussion amongst the horse racing industry is the implementation of the new federal Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, known as HISA. HISA was passed by Congress in late 2020 in one of the COVID relief bills, and the first set of safety-related rules went into effect July of 2022. The next set of rules related to anti-doping and medication controls are set to take effect later this month. Now, Minnesota is in a very good position to actually incorporate the rules that are laid out in the federal, both in the federal law and the federal regulations, because Minnesota has long been a leader in the horse racing and has a strong reputation for safety and integrity. However, the legislation that Congress passed did not provide any funding for the oversight authority charged with implementation of that federal oversight. Instead, state racing commissions and the racing industry are being assessed for all of the operational costs of that oversight entity. For 2023, that oversight entity has assessed Minnesota a bill of nearly $1 million. To help during this time of transition to incorporate the new layer of federal oversight and the new regulations, the commission is asking for a one-time $1 million appropriation in the governor's budget. This proposal has been well received by the track. This is, I'll just note that HISA only applies to thoroughbred racing, so it only applies to the thoroughbreds that are racing at Canterbury, not the standardbreds at Running Aces. It's been well received by the track, as well as horsepersons or organizations, as this is a, this would be an appropriation that would help this industry, which is a significant economic generator. And a 2017 U of M study found that horse racing has a nearly $500 million impact on the state's economy. As this year's racing season approaches, the Racing Commission is committed to maintaining the state's strong reputation of safety and integrity in horse racing. Our capacity to do so will be greatly enhanced with this appropriation. I'll end with just an open invitation to any member who's curious about more about what the Racing Commission does and what our race day operations look like. As despite the weather, we are just a few weeks away from the start of race season, and I invite you to come out to our offices at either track and we'll show you around.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony. Members, do you have questions? Representative Kosnick.
I do, Madam Chair, and as the lead on the Economic Development Committee, I appreciate, and being in the South Metro in Dakota County next to Scott County. And I do have some Scott County, but not Canterbury in my district. You'd mentioned the $500 million economic impact, and that's greatly felt throughout our South Metro districts, but it's important across the state. So I appreciate the work that the Race Commission has done. And that was a 2017 study. I'd be curious for your comments, if we have time, Madam Chair, just on the outlook of the racing industry in Minnesota, the economic, continuing the economic impact that they have, that the race industry has, and we want to make sure that we protect that industry as a provides resilience to our state economy and a lot of jobs in the South Metro, but really throughout the state, and a lot of the horses and the people that work with them, the vendors, and a lot of stuff going on down there. And if you could have a few minutes just to talk about that, I would be very intrigued in hearing, and provide additional support for that industry through the Economic Development Committee, perhaps, and we could have some partners here in this committee to support that.
Thank you. Would you like to respond?
Gladly. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick. You're correct that this is not an industry that is just, you know, centered around Scott County or Northeast Anoka County around Running Aces. Instead, it does have statewide impact. For example, I was just looking recently at the farm visits that we do. So every spring, as part of the full registration process that would entitle a breeder to later receive awards for Minnesota bred horses, is we go out and we actually verify the foals that have been registered to see the farms. And these are scattered all over the state. And so as a result, when you have a farm that's breeding horses, you need veterinary care, you need feed, you need to replace barns and update barns and replace equipment. So of that $500 million impact that the U of M found in 2017, the majority of that was actually related to non-direct horse racing industries, so significant manufacturing and also agribusiness impacts, particularly in greater Minnesota. As far as the economic outlook for racing, we do have a very strong reputation here. People like to come back every year and race in Minnesota. That said, owners and trainers will come back when it's economically viable to do so, and one of the most significant factors that will draw them back is purse money. And so the tracks are in a continual effort to ensure that they have adequate purse money to draw people back and have sources for purse money to ensure that they can bring people back. The tracks are committed to racing. They are investing in their facilities, particularly Canterbury has done quite a bit of investment lately, and they're in a barn replacement and upgrading project. I know that they're out right now recruiting across the country to bring owners and trainers back for the summer. And so owners and trainers do want to return here. I've spoken with people in the industry that want to continue to breed their horses here, and they're just looking for stability to make sure that when they invest here, there's a long-term future for them in Minnesota.
And I would just say that we can encourage people to staycation and do all the wonderful things that Minnesota has to offer. So any further questions or comments?
Sure.
Vice Chair Hewitt.
Thank you for indulging me, Madam. What is an average purse out at Canterbury? Can you answer that?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. As far as the average, I don't know the actual average. There are certain events, certain stakes, races that have higher purses.
How about high and low?
Several $100,000 on the high end to $10,000 on the low end.
Considerably more than your legislative salary. Maybe.
I'm working on it.
You'd have to run as fast as a horse, though.
Yeah, right, true. Are there any other questions or concerns? We thank you so much for coming today, presenting your needs to us, and thank you for your work for Minnesota.
Thank you.
And members, with that, I think that's all we have to do today. Our business being concluded,
it's early.
We are adjourned.